From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we'll look back at Governor Walker's State of the State address last night. Later, is the climate for compromise changing in Washington? Plus, a Milwaukee group brings people together to revitalize inner-city neighborhoods.
Our executive director, Leo Reese, he likes to describe our work as convening but not controlling. We like to set the table and bring people to the table. But what gets put on the table is determined by them. They are individuals who are in the kitchen who we think are much better cooks and much better chefs than we are.
And the Milwaukee Opera Theater treats audiences to a remarkable chance.
Over the course of 2.5 hours, you get to see four kind of miniature opera experiences. Plus, there's time to walk through the passageways where we have all of the students' visual art displayed.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Governor Walker delivered the final State of the State address of his first term as governor last night. The speech was heavy on economic themes, his record as a job creator, his plans for income and property tax relief, his priorities for a projected budget surplus. It was very light on social legislation in this election year. We're joined this morning by Mordecai Lee, professor of governmental affairs at the UW-Milwaukee School of Continuing Education and an occasional Lake Effect political analyst. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me, Mitch.
This is a pretty rosy picture of the Wisconsin economy that Scott Walker painted in this speech last night. In fact, the governor spoke almost entirely on economic issues in the talk. Why do you think the speech was so singularly focused?
Well, sometimes in America, we like to look down on politicians. We like to criticize politicians. So for you and me to talk about the fact that it's a political speech, I don't think is a bad thing. In fact, I think it's good when politicians act like politicians. Here's a guy who's giving his last State of the State. He's going to face the voters before the next possible State of the State. He's trying to lay out his record. Here's what I've done. Here's how I kept my promises. And so I think it was appropriate. If we go back 3 years when he first ran for election, he really ran as somebody who cared about creating jobs. You'd barely know he was a Republican, and you certainly wouldn't know that he was, let's say, pro-life or any of those other divisive social issues. So I think this is both perfectly a match with what he ran for and a match for how he wants to run for re-election.
And moreover, there was not an enormous laundry list of social issue kinds of topics that he raised. This was entirely this is what he wants to do with taxes. This is what he wants to do vis-a-vis job creation. This is what he wants to do in terms of jobs for people with disabilities.
Mitch, I really think you've put your finger on I guess you'd call it the Scott Walker approach. And that's that, yes, he's a Republican. Yes, he's a conservative. Yes, he's essentially Tea Party or talk radio. But that his political formula is he never talks about social issues. He only talks about creating jobs, putting money back in the pockets of hardworking taxpayers. By the way, I want to hear once about a non-hardworking taxpayer. It's almost like it's one word, hardworking taxpayer. He only talks about that. That's how he ran for election 3 years ago. That's how he's going to run for re-election. And frankly, that's how he's going to run for president. And so by never talking about those hot-button Republican-based social issues, he presents himself as a non-divisive Republican, a Republican who cares about what essentially Democrats said they care about, which is jobs and job security.
That and tax relief. He talked a great deal about income tax relief and property tax relief.
It was really interesting that he's putting all his bets on one side of the table.
This is the so-called blueprint for prosperity.
Mitch, I'm so old that I remember sitting in the chambers of the state assembly when Lee Dreyfus, the newly elected governor, who in 1978 he won, in 1979 he gave his first State of the State, he beat Martin Schreiber, and his theme was give the surplus back. And as it turned out, history was not on his side. As it turned out, there was then a recession in 81, 82. Governor Dreyfus had to add a fifth cent on the sales tax as a temporary measure. Then Tony Earle made it a permanent. But I so flashed back to it, and I know that Scott Walker is a very good politician, and he would know about those kinds of stories. But clearly what he was doing is he's all in, I'm going to give the surplus back. And he's willing to take the risk that either the economy goes south or the structural deficit gets bigger. I thought that's a pretty breathtaking kind of decision. And it really shows you, again, what his political philosophy is and where he stands ideologically.
Well, and it's also one that's already gotten kind of a mixed reaction from people in his own party. Some Republicans have been pretty cautious about this in terms of whether cutting taxes further is more important than hanging on to a surplus and dealing with a structural deficit. Is there some political potential, political cover anyway, for the governor here that he has the luxury of being able to propose these things regardless of whether his own party is even going to side with him?
Mitch, I really think you're onto something. And what I'd like to suggest is that in our lifetime, the meaning of the word conservative has changed. And I guess you'd say the old meaning of conservative is to be conservative with money, to be fiscally prudent. And so the kind of voices that we're hearing from some state senators who are Republicans, and by the way, they're veteran Republicans. In other words, they remember history. The kind of talk that we're hearing about, whoa, there's a structural deficit coming up, let's pay down the deficit, let's be prudent, let's not give it all back and then regret it. I think that's the old meaning of conservative. And when you describe the speech of Governor Walker essentially saying cut taxes, cut taxes, cut taxes, that's really the new meaning of being a conservative. And I think this is very reflective of what's happening in Washington, where to be a conservative is to cut taxes. You almost don't care about anything else and regardless of the consequences. And furthermore, there's a kind of a subtle thing about starving the beast, because let's say Scott Walker cuts taxes too much, and let's say going into the next biennium there is a significant structural deficit. Well, to Republican conservatives of this new meaning of conservative, this is a wonderful bonanza. Why? Because it justifies cutting spending even more. So I think what we're seeing is how much of a new conservative Scott Walker is versus an old-fashioned conservative.
What stood out as missing from this speech? You hinted at this a little bit, but I don't recall any legislative priorities referenced that did not involve taxes or funding. I know the Journal Sentinel, for example, had editorialized a few days ago that they would hope he would take on something like redistricting reform. None of that was in the speech.
None of that was in the speech. This was a very Republican ideology speech. This is how they see the world, and this is their values. And so he didn't talk about any good government reforms. The word Milwaukee barely passed his lips. I counted twice. He named some companies that people worked for, and the word Milwaukee was in their title. But he didn't talk about Milwaukee. He didn't talk about African Americans, even when he talked about the state pension system. Now, who cares about the state pension system except people who are public employees? And I should state that I am a public employee.
As am I.
But he packaged the good pension system for public employees in Wisconsin as a thing that will attract private sector businesses.
At this stage, his presumptive opponent in November is Mary Burke. He, of course, did not refer to Mary Burke by name in this speech. But was the specter of Mary Burke lurking someplace?
I think very much so. And again, there's nothing wrong with it. That's where we started our conversation. We should want politicians to be politicians because that makes democracy work. It gives us choices. And for example, I think it was interesting that when he started his speech, first he introduced a winner of the Medal of Honor. But then the very next group he introduced was his wife and sons and parents. And I sort of wonder if he's trying to draw a comparison on a personal level with Mary Burke. Mary Burke happens not to be married, happens not to have kids. I wonder if he's trying to say, I'm a family man, and I understand what you, the struggling middle class, is facing, because I've got boys who are going to college. And then the silent refrain is, not only is she a millionaire, but she's not married, she doesn't have kids, she doesn't have to worry about college tuition. So I think that might be, again, part of the very effective Scott Walker formula to say, I'm like you, I understand you, I'm going to talk only about economic issues, and I'm not going to talk about other hot-button social issues.
Mordecai Lee, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Mordecai Lee is a professor of governmental affairs at UW-Milwaukee's School of Continuing Education, a former Democratic state legislator, and author of several books, including Promoting the War Effort, Robert Horton, and Federal Propaganda, 1938 to 1946. On to national politics, we discuss the recently passed federal spending bill with Congresswoman Gwen Moore when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. With a Senate vote last weekend, the talk of gridlock in Washington came to at least a temporary end. The Senate gave thumbs up to the omnibus spending bill that the U.S. House of Representatives approved earlier in the week and which funds the federal government through the end of the fiscal year. But there are still major areas of concern for some Wisconsinites. Congress has not passed an extension of federal unemployment benefits. Passage of a farm bill has not materialized. And privacy concerns still exist, even after President Obama announced his initiative for major changes to the NSA's data collection policies. Democratic Congresswoman Gwen Moore of Milwaukee is back in her district this week, and she's with us in the studio. Welcome back to the show.
Mitch, it's great being here with you today. It's a little nippy. But this is Wisconsin.
We'll warm things up on the radio. Let me start with the omnibus budget bill that passed last week. And let me start by asking you where you think it might have fallen short.
Well, you know, obviously, it's a good news, bad news story here. I mean, the good news is that we moved the ball forward on finishing all 12 appropriations bills. We've been stuck. So that's I guess I want to say something good about it. Certainly it fell short in a really obvious way when we didn't extend unemployment benefits for the long term unemployed. I think that that hurts our economy. Nationwide, here in Wisconsin, we started out with 1.3 million people who didn't get those checks the first week of December 28th. And of course, we add 72,000 people every week and a couple million children. All told, if this goes on for a year, that'll be 200,000 jobs that we'll lose. And it not only has an impact on those people who are unemployed, obviously, but it has an impact on those merchants and vendors out there who aren't getting those receipts for food and clothing. Landlords may be missing out on getting their monies. And so there's a ripple effect to it.
You were, though, willing to vote for this package, even though it fell short in that key area for you. How do you make the call that what becomes important or more important is passing something rather than prolonging the debates?
Well, you know, and that's just it. I guess the older I get, the more conservative I get, and the more I understand really what the word compromise means. The sequester really held a lot of people hostage, individuals and business. And I guess to borrow some lexicon from Maria Shriver, when we think about the numbers of people who are just, and especially women, who are literally living just on the edge of existence, living on the fringes, we really ended, curtailed a lot of misery for a lot of people by passing some sort of budget. I mean, we provided school lunches for about 32 a million eligible school children, which is significant. Senior meals, the Head Start program. We brought back, some funding, $1 billion increase for that program, which many low income parents rely on. Certainly, disaster funding, community prevention grants. We restored some money to the National Institutes of Health, and I could go on and on and on. Pell grants protected that investment. So there were things that I thought were worthwhile supporting. And so I'm not dancing in the street about it, but there was $1 trillion worth of spending that was desperately needed. And at least for 2014, it gets us through 2014. And we'll be sort of back in the same boat 2015 and beyond, but it moves the ball forward.
Well, and as you say, you'll be in the same boat as 2015 comes along. What is your current sense for the climate in Washington? Does the passage of these appropriations bills, along with, say, the work of Congressman Ryan and Senator Murray, does it indicate a shift in the climate for compromise in Washington?
Well, just let me say, I want to give due compliments to Representative Ryan, whose constituents are within, you know, within your listening area. And I do think that I agree with him. You know, if you're in the majority, Republicans are in the majority, you have the responsibility to govern. And so he's taken a lot of hits and criticisms for doing anything, because the Republicans, in my experience, they don't like this budget initiative. They don't like the $1 trillion in spending, which is far below where we have been. And they would like to carry us back to a point in time when government does practically nothing. And so I do think that while I'm complimenting Representative Ryan and Senator Murray, I'm also raising a real precautionary note that this isn't some sort of big magnanimous bill to help a lot of people. There's still a lot of pain and suffering, not only to individuals, but to our larger economy that will sustain if we don't get beyond these sequester levels.
So even with the passage of the omnibus bill, as you mentioned, unemployment benefits were not included in that, an extension of unemployment benefits. Analysts say the coming days might represent really the last time that an extension of benefits might be a feasible vote. How do you view where that issue is today?
Well, I can tell you, you have members of Congress and, of course, the United States Senate, who literally have the philosophical view that by extending these unemployment benefits, even in an environment where economists have measured and said that we are 7% and above, we are at sort of a critical threshold, that it discourages people from working. And so they can come up with an example of someone who wouldn't take a job because, hey, I'm getting my unemployment benefits. The reality is that our economy is still recovering. It's still very, very soft. Then there are plenty of people who have advanced degrees, a lot of experience, and they are actually not finding any jobs. The $7 an hour job, $7.50 an hour job that they might try to find, other people are scurrying to take those benefits. I think someone has a master's degree, someone offering a $7.50, $8 an hour job is not in a hurry to provide them with that job, knowing that they won't stay there if they get a job in their choice. In the meantime, while this debate is raging, we're cutting food stamps. We're cutting unemployment benefits. We're vilifying anybody who gets any sort of government assistance, Pell Grants, and people who were middle class are now finding themselves right on the edge.
There are some Republicans who say they'd be more willing to support an extension of unemployment benefits if they were offset by spending cuts elsewhere. What's your take on whether the extension of benefits ought to be contingent on finding money from someplace else to put into these benefits?
Well, I can tell you that while there have been pay-fors, it's rare. Ever since we have had any kind of employment, unemployment level at 7% or above, Democrats, Republicans, you know, whether the president has been Republican, the House or Senate has been occupied by Republicans or Democrats, we have extended these unemployment benefits. We get how our capitalist economy works, that you need unemployment, and offsetting it with what? With programs and other spending that helps people. It's rare that we have required an offset.
Do you think it's a debate that will be driven now by constituents as you and your colleagues are home and in your districts, or would you expect or want the White House to play a more visible role?
Well, I can tell you that we have such gerrymandered district that those debates, you know, are not occurring in ordinary districts. You know, those members of Congress who may come from very wealthy enclaves and they don't really care about the unemployed. And I do hope that the president will use his executive authority to I don't know that he can raise unemployment benefits, but he can do stuff like raise the minimum wage, perhaps. This will take a legislative fix, and I do think that we need to try to rally the people out there. And let me just say this, Mitch, while we still have time. This is not just a problem of those who are unemployed. You know, when we think about Penny's, JCPenney's being in trouble, think about Best Buy not making their bottom line during the holiday, think about all those checks starting December 28th that didn't go out and beyond. There's a $1.50 economic benefit for every unemployment check that's sent out. And those folks spend every single dime of it. I mean, that very first week of December 28th, 23,700 people in Wisconsin lost their benefits, the average benefit of about $266. But that was $6.3 million statewide. I mean, that's Piggly Wiggly and Roundies that lost money, Pick and Save, Payless Shoes, Best Buy. Those small businesses in our community that lost $6.3 million that one week. And every week we add 72,000 people nationwide. And so it's not just those persons and their families that lose that economic benefit. It harms our economy.
Let's move on to one other area that the president did use his executive authority for. He, in the past week, announced his plans to pare back large-scale surveillance programs, most significantly that the government would no longer be the keeper of all the records gathered in these massive sweeps. What's your take on the direction the president is suggesting that things move?
Well, Mitch, let me just say, we'll have to wait and see. I think the biggest takeaway from his announcement was that he was going to have some sort of public agency involved in these surveillance decisions, these FISA court decisions. I mean, previously, and I remember being strenuously objecting to this while we were considering the legislation, that nobody like a public advocate was there to question whether or not we should gather these kind of data. And so when they talk about, so that I think is very significant. The other thing I think is very significant is his saying that we won't keep these records permanently. But then where will they go? How will they be disposed of? If the public doesn't store them, can we trust some private agency to store them? I don't know that I think that's a good idea. So I think that I think the president is making some effort to respond to the criticism, and we'll just see if it's enough.
You sound like you might be still a little skeptical at this point.
Well, I was not supportive of this wide reach. I do respect the fact that we've got to I don't want to second guess our intelligence services. I do realize realistically that these kinds of covert activities must take place. But I'm relying on some very studied, balanced approach.
Well, I hope we can talk to you again about it as these plans might move forward. Congresswoman Gwen Moore, thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Yeah, and thank you, too.
Democrat Gwen Moore represents Wisconsin's 4th Congressional District, which includes Milwaukee and parts of the North and South Shore suburbs. An organization works to revitalize inner-city Milwaukee. We'll learn about its distinctive approach when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. We've all heard the negative stereotypes of inner-city Milwaukee as a place in crisis. Violent crime, high rates of foreclosures, problems with drugs are all often linked with the city. While there are unquestionably problems facing our communities, those issues don't necessarily tell the full story, and that's where LISC Milwaukee comes in. It's a local chapter of the national group, the Local Initiative Support Corporation, and it wants to break down those perceptions and help revitalize distressed neighborhoods. By bringing together community partners and taking key policymakers on tours through the five communities they work in, LISC is showing off what's to love about Milwaukee. Christopher Boston is Director of Sustainable Communities for LISC Milwaukee. Dawn Hutchison Weiss is Director of Communications there. They tell Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce more about the organization's work.
I think there is a significant misperception about what's going on in the city, who lives in the city, what kind of people, what kind of neighborhoods, what kind of families, what kind of businesses are operating here. And I have to quote my boss. He says, you know, I think a lot of people believe, you know, Milwaukee is a cesspool of decay and despair, and it's really not the case. And I think that our work is moving more and more into helping to educate people about, you know, the real people who are working hard every day to improve the quality of life in their neighborhoods. And I know we've been doing a lot of bus tours and a lot of outreach. We've been developing an honorary board because the truth is that for Milwaukee to succeed, we need the investment of the broader Southeast region and the state, really. We're doing more and more to help educate legislators and thought leaders outside of the city and, you know, ask them to invest, ask them to advocate, and just to get to know what's really happening here.
What are some of the examples that you highlight in these bus tours and the outreach work that you do that's really changing perceptions?
I would say we confront them. We just confront them. And the best way to confront them is to get people on a bus, to get them in the neighborhood, and to get them in front of the individuals who are working to transform these places. Then I think they get a sense of really what's taking place, and they understand. The individuals in those neighborhoods want the same things they want. They want safer streets. They want better schools. They want homes that reflect the kind of lifestyle that they'd like to live. Then I think you can see in some instances a light bulb go off in their mind where they're like, wow. Sometimes they say things like, I never knew all of these things were happening in this neighborhood. I mean, how many places can you go, like Lindsay Heights neighborhood, where you have the largest peach orchard in the state of Wisconsin and then the best corned beef all within one block? You can't go to a neighborhood like Clark Square that has the asset of the Mitchell Park domes, but then also in that same park is where you have some really extensive youth programming and one of the largest elementary schools in the state of Wisconsin at Henry Longfellow School. You know, what about going to a place like Washington Park? You know, a lot of times people don't recognize that the park itself within Washington Park is actually where we used to have our zoo. A lot of people don't recognize that the park that was designed in Washington Park was designed by Frederick Law Olmsted, who also designed Central Park. You have two of Milwaukee's oldest anchors in Miller Brewing Company and Harley Davidson, located really within that neighborhood. And if you get to these places, you'll see all that's taking place in these neighborhoods that really speak to what we can be in this city.
So how do you walk that line between not wanting to gloss over the realities of the challenges these neighborhoods may be facing with highlighting the positive stories that are going on there?
So let me just reference a couple of different things. You know, one, I come out of a community organizing tradition, and there's a thought in community organizing tradition which speaks to the world as it is and the world as it should be. And it's sort of founded on a theological perspective that speaks of the already and the not yet. In many ways, our neighborhoods and our cities are in between those places, the world as it is and the world as it should be, the already and the not yet. We already have talented individuals who live in these neighborhoods, compassionate individuals who look out for one another as residents, and passionate individuals who lead with the perspective to change and transform these neighborhoods. But, you know, they're not yet what they should be. There's still issues of crime and violence in the neighborhoods in some instances. There's still issues of large amounts of unemployment within the neighborhoods. And in some instances, there are issues where there's some hopelessness that exists within these neighborhoods. But what we've experienced is that the compassion that the leaders have who work to address the issues in these neighborhoods far exceeds the challenges that these neighborhoods present.
LISC's work focuses on trying to build the infrastructure of a neighborhood to better support itself. And so I think in the tours and when we talk to people, we try to highlight that aspect of the work. You know, the fundamental work that we do with each of our neighborhoods is to help them develop a quality of life plan, which takes anywhere from 6 months to a year to develop. And it's a process of bringing residents together, sharing their hopes, their aspirations, their challenges. And a lot of very serious issues come out at these meetings, obviously. And so that process of helping a neighborhood organize itself and come up with a common set of priorities that they can agree upon and putting it to paper and creating a very specific plan for their future is very powerful. And they use that as a roadmap for investment and buy-in and engagement in their neighborhood. A lot of the work that we do is also around making connections because, you know, we're working in some of the most disenfranchised communities, you know, in our city, but in some ways in the country. So, and part of that characteristic of some of these neighborhoods is a lack of connection to resources and assets and technical support. So LISC is really uniquely positioned because we have very strong relationships with lenders and the private sector and the city of Milwaukee, as well as with community leaders. So we can play a really unique role in helping, you know, investors connect up with projects that are really going to make a big difference in driving change in the neighborhoods, and then also helping the neighborhood partners connect up with resources to fulfill their, you know, dreams and plans.
As we quote our executive director, Leo Reese, he likes to describe our work as convening but not controlling. We like to set the table and bring people to the table. But what gets put on the table is determined by them. There are individuals who are in the kitchen who we think are much better cooks and much better chefs than we are. And the things that they put on the table we think are going to be much better if they do it than versus we do it. But we do feel like that it's our responsibility to set the table.
Well, so tell us about some of the successes that you've had. Where have you seen some of these connections been made, and where have you been able to really change minds?
Well, we can go over a series of examples. One, again, in Washington Park in that neighborhood. The lead agency in that neighborhood is United Methodist Children's Services, an organization that's been around for 40 years, providing resources to women and children, particularly women who are aging out of foster care. You know, as we began to engage them in conversation, we learned that they had a desire and aspiration to do much more than what they were doing, which was great work. They had transformed the lives of thousands of young women within this area, within this city. But they really began to see that their work was fundamentally, they were really working for something bigger. As they talked to us, we began to really assess what it is they really wanted to do. And from that standpoint, they went from being, you know, a social service provider in the neighborhood to a provider of affordable housing in the neighborhood and supportive housing for those same women who were transitioning out of foster care and transitioning out of their transitional living into more permanent housing. And so they were able to acquire land within that neighborhood, demolish some homes, and then build scattered site townhomes within the neighborhood. And then they had three apartment development projects within that neighborhood. And if you look in that neighborhood now, you can see the change that takes place really speaks to the neighborhood's aspirations and really its future. And that all happened based on a conversation. And so you begin to connect the dots. And then with that, you begin to see other people investing within the neighborhood. In the next couple of years, you're going to see a new clinic within that neighborhood by Progressive Health Centers. You're also going to see increased investment from other institutions. Habitat for Humanity is going to build 120 new homes within that neighborhood in the next 3 to 5 years. And so that transformation takes place all by one conversation. And then as you bring people together, you begin to see these changes take place in real tangible ways.
You know, we've been working with Washington Park neighborhood for about 7 years. And if you ask residents in that neighborhood, they say that they can feel a difference. You know, they feel like there's forward momentum. And Habitat for Humanity chose to announce this, you know, $20 million commitment to that neighborhood very specifically because that neighborhood is well organized now.
I would imagine, though, that there are occasionally setbacks. How do you make sure that the message you're trying to get out and these connections you're trying to build continue in the face of a setback?
The individuals who are working in the neighborhoods where we work recover very effectively and in some ways very quickly. And one example we have is an incident of violence that happened in May of this year. It was about 2.5 weeks after we celebrated the release of our new community safety initiative and our partnership with the Milwaukee Police Department in Washington Park itself, with a lot of fanfare and media coverage. And just 2.5 weeks later, in an area that had been revitalized to be a new play space for young people in the northern part of the neighborhood, there was a homicide. But what happened was an immediate response, not to say this is just something that we have to deal with, but to say we understand that this is a challenge, but the neighborhood is still growing. We understand that this is a challenge, but the Milwaukee Police Department is working with individuals on the ground to deal with the challenge that this issue presents, and also to understand the context of the matter. And that is, while that neighborhood still had some challenges in terms of crime and some violence, that the Milwaukee Police Department had been working very effectively to pinpoint the issues of violence. And really, their data speaks to that there's a small subset of criminal actors within the neighborhood that are doing most of that criminal activity. If they could focus their efforts on those individuals, the rest of the neighborhood that wants it to be a safer place can work towards that goal. The point is, we're working together to change perceptions, because we understand that a story like this can really do a lot of damage to the overall progress of an initiative. But if we continue to focus on the growth, the evolution, and the hope that exists within the neighborhood, then we think that we can do great things to change perceptions and really get people to understand that these are vibrant places and spaces that have a whole lot of rhythm.
It seems so simple, but it's almost like the lengths that a conversation alone can go, that engaging and talking with people can have such an impact in and of itself.
I think that's sometimes why our work is hard to explain, because a lot of the work that we do has to do with building relationships. And I know, to quote Leo again, we're going to give him a big head, but you know, when things get tough, sometimes in relationships that we're working with internally, you know, he'll say that is the work. That is the work of, that we're doing. It's to try and build bridges across groups and people and build collaboration and build understanding.
Milwaukee's neighborhoods are a treasure chest of hope, activity, assets, information, and just wonderful people. And I think that as we continue to look at all that's happening within our neighborhoods and find ways to connect these neighborhoods with the broader economic agenda, I think in the end, we will have a much better product and we'll have a much stronger narrative as we look back on all the work that took place to transform our city.
Christopher Boston and Dawn Hutchinson-Weiss, thank you so much for coming in and telling us about LISC Milwaukee.
Thanks for having us, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Christopher Boston is Director of Sustainable Communities for LISC Milwaukee. Dawn Hutchinson-Weiss is Director of Communications. They spoke with Stephanie Lecce in October. More recently, Stephanie went out on one of those tours to one neighborhood. We'll hear some highlights from that tour on Lake Effect next week. Two big productions are on the way from the Milwaukee Opera Theater. We'll get the high notes when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Teich. The Milwaukee Opera Theater began in 1998 as a way to provide professional opportunities for artists in the Milwaukee area. It also offers composers a chance to write smaller-scale works that might never make it to a larger community such as the Florentine, and gives audiences a chance to see them. And since Jill Anaponicek was named artistic director in 2008, the company has enhanced that mission. This weekend, the company produces the Eurydice Festival at Carroll University. It's based on the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice in the underworld and features three compositions commissioned by the company, including one by Carroll students. And next month, the company collaborates with UWM in Ravel's one-act opera, L'Enfant et le Sortilège. Lake Effect Bonnie North sat down with Ponicek, along with Milwaukee composer Joel Boyd and UWM choreographer and puppeteer Edward Winslow, to talk about the project. Ponicek says the festival comes at the end of a three-year process.
We've been developing stories, songs, and visual art inspired by the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice over the course of 3 years now. So this is the very final shebang this weekend. And then 2 weeks from now, we engage in our largest co-production to date with UWM, Symphony Orchestra, Dance Department, and Milwaukee Opera Theater of Ravel's L'Enfant et le Sortilège.
Okay, so two very different things. With Eurydice, 3 years in the making, but there's also, we have one of the composers here, but this is a lot of original music for this. A lot of composers have written that, yeah, that myth into opera, but this is all new, right?
One of the ways that we're engaging with the story is to think about this myth from antiquity that has been processed by different artists over millennia. And last year, as a commitment to new work, we issued three commissions to area composers to write new pieces for area artists. And their only parameter was that they had to interpret the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice. And it had to be producible by Milwaukee Opera Theater. So they wrote on a fairly small scale. And Joel Boyd is here, who wrote a new opera called The Crawling Dove for three singers and a small chamber ensemble.
Okay. But before we get to that, mm-hmm, Joel, tell me very quickly, mm-hmm, the Cliff Notes version of the myth for people who don't know what it is.
Orpheus and Eurydice were very much in love. And on their wedding day, Eurydice is bitten by a snake. She's a very famous snake bite victim and taken to the underworld. Orpheus was so bereft at the loss of his wife Eurydice that he braved the journey to the underworld, played his lyre so beautifully before Hades, and won Eurydice back on one condition, that he walk in front of her on their way back to the mortal plane and not look back. And he looked.
Thus, it's a tragedy.
Thus, yes.
And so
it
she
is
was,
a tragedy.
And she ended up, mm-hmm, back in the underworld forever. She could never leave.
That is
again.
True, yes. Although there are so many interpretations of the myth. I think there is one translation where they do make it out.
Oh, but, okay. Mm-hmm. So now, Joel, when you were approaching this as a composer, where were you coming into the story?
I believe I was coming in a couple thousand years after everybody else worked on this piece. So that was one of the first things that struck me, is how many pieces and how much art exists around this myth, and what, as a composer, can you contribute that's completely new to something so old. So I found myself going back to the various versions of the story, and the one that struck me the most was actually the somewhat lesser-known part of the myth, which is from Virgil's Georgics and not Ovid's Metamorphosis.
We asked the composers to use Ovid, and Joel went rogue and chose Virgil instead.
And so what is different about that particular version of the story?
The Virgil has an extra character in there that is not in the Ovid, and his name is Aristaeus. He's a beekeeper, and he's not an innocent beekeeper in this story. He harasses and chases Eurydice, and it's a little mysterious as to whether or not he was the cause of her death, where he chased her and she fell and was bitten by the snake, or he tried to rape her, or some other variation of that. So that seemed very curious to me, that this was not as common in other pieces. So I got my wheel spinning on that and took it from there.
Another thing that I find fascinating about this is that not only have you been working on it for 3 years, you've got 45 artists involved, four mm-hmm. venues yeah. involved, and 2 days.
Yeah. I was ready to throw the towel in when it came to scheduling the rehearsals.
I bet.
I think our largest production before this was 16 people. And so the Eurydice Festival involves 45 different artists working on 4 different shows in 4 different venues over 2 days. And each team for each production is distinct. So there are no overlapping artists. So they all are rehearsing on separate timelines in different venues, all in the same theater complex at Carroll University. But the whole building is like electrified with all things Eurydice right now. And there are so many students running around and fixing this and that and setting lights and props and developing the hallways and putting up visual art. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful madhouse right now.
Now, it takes place over the 2 days. Are people going to get to see all four pieces?
They do.
Pieces? Okay.
That's part of what, you know, caused my brain to practically implode, sort of trying to figure out how we can usher the audience through each experience. So each piece is less than 30 minutes, and there are intermissions between each one. And so over the course of 2.5 hours, you get to see 4 kind of miniature opera experiences, plus there's time to walk through the passageways where we have all of the students' visual art displayed. I don't think I mentioned that, but in addition to all the operas, 2 photography classes and an intaglio printmaking class at Carroll University have all read the myth and done assignments inspired by the myth, and so we also have these big displays
of
student artwork, and several faculty members have also contributed visual art to the project. So it's really an integrated
I was going to say it's a complete experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there are cupcakes.
Of course.
Yeah. We really wanted to sort of because we have these intermissions and because each piece is so small, you know, I mean, Joel's piece is this incredibly encapsulated 30-minute opera. It's really, it feels like an opera. You feel like you've been through this Greek tragedy, but it all goes by so quickly. It's just done in a blink. And so we wanted to create an environment where people could talk about what they just saw and share their experience. And so food is a pretty important part of that.
And
so.
Cupcakes are always lovely because they're fun. You can have more than one.
I think we were trying to find an antidote for all the tragedy. So we sort of tried to choose the most cheerful food we could think of.
Cupcakes are good.
You know?
Yes.
Because Eurydice just keeps dying. But you can go have a cupcake in between the shows.
In between. So. Yeah. Well, now we're going to turn. We have a puppet in the studio, and I understand Anton is his name.
He's just been christened.
He's just been christened Anton.
Yeah.
So, Ed, tell me a little bit about this and what this particular project is, because this is coming in a couple of weeks.
Uh-huh.
Which is another reason why your hair is shorter, because you've been pulling it out.
Right. I've been literally pulling it out.
You were saying the Eurydice project is 45, so it's a step up from that to almost 100 people in L'Enfant et la Sortilège. It was an opera written in 1925 by Maurice Ravel with the libretto by Colette. And it was at that time, as I understand it, the Paris Opera's answer to Nijinsky's L'Après-midi d'Enfant. And so they were looking for something really absurd and eye-catching and over the top to match the, I don't know if they were rave reviews, riots.
The riotous reviews, I think you could say, yeah.
Nijinsky's work. So it's a classic, and we're doing a unclassic retelling, which Jillian and I, she brought me a photograph of a giant bubble wrap person, basically, and a small child or actress. And we decided that we wanted to use found objects and materials that are recycled and that are can be found in your home. So one thing led to another, and pretty soon we had a concept for the show, which was based on a child's tantrum, sort of, you know, on the order of Where the Wild Things Are.
It kicks it off. His tantrum sort of kicks off the show.
Yeah, and the tantrum starts things, and the child turns around, and the chair is suddenly talking to him. We decided we wanted to put the environment, you know, not only in a current time period, but also to have the environment of this child be that they're moving. And it's the 31st of the month.
His family is moving. Everything is packed up. And he has a nuclear meltdown as the movers are coming to take
everything
away.
And somehow it's going to – I think that's going to tap into some, you know, personal experiences that some of us may have had on that last day when you have to get everything out and you really are not ready. So the movers come in. And as the play begins, before the music even starts, the doors open and we hear the sound of the truck backing up. And the movers, this big cast of characters, is all a moving company. And they come into the space and they look around and, whoa, ho, 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 the stuff's not ready to go. And that sort of begins one episode
after another.
We sort of
decided that they're the worst moving company in the world.
A lot of people might volunteer their moving companies for
that. Come in and make it even worse.
And now, this is not a huge – it's not a grand opera, right, in terms of length.
It's a tiny – It's an oddity in that way. It's only 45 minutes long in actual musical duration. It's one act. It's this surrealist libretto. But it's an enormous full symphony orchestra score for 60-some instruments and a huge cast of characters, 20-some characters. And so the piece is brief but enormous. Colette wrote the libretto in, I think, 8 days. And then it took Ravel 7 years to complete the score. There was a world war in there, too. He got distracted. But, it's really a remarkably peculiar, beautiful piece. The machines and the effects, there's a – I think it's a cheese grater in the orchestra. I mean, there are all these mechanical sounds. Ravel was so interested in machines and mechanical toys, which also is one of the things that I love very much about Edward's direction with the puppetry, is that he's actually building little contraptions out of, you know, boxes for the piece, which seems to me like a beautiful agreement with Ravel's aesthetic.
In terms of who's doing the singing, is Milwaukee Opera Theater providing the major singers in this, or are you using students? How
we
is that
actually
working?
Really distinctly avoided that, like a situation where we have sort of professional ringers and then everyone else is a student. We've really tried to integrate it. So the L'Enfant is Allison Hall, an area professional mezzo who's terrific. And then our other singers are kind of in the texture with the students. So we hope that it will be as blended as possible. But Tim Rebers is joining us, Henry Hammond, and Brett Hanisco.
And then, of course, Anton.
And Anton the Frog.
Anton the Frog is made out of four wine boxes. and his eyes are ping pong balls.
In plastic cups. You have to have the full effect.
We challenged ourselves pretty early on not to buy anything. And so we've been scrounging dumpsters, making phone calls, restaurant supply, corporations, knocking on doors and asking for things that they would dispose of, either recycle or throw in the trash. And so everything is made out of something that we have bubble wrap from Crate and Barrel and wine boxes from Trader Joe's and coffee cups from Colectivo work. And we've had an incredible team of people gathering materials from around town for us. Edward has not painted or changed the look of anything, so you can see labels and you can see the original shape of whatever the item is. But through movement and lighting, I think you will sort of find yourself staring at the puppets and trying to figure out what they were made of. And you'll, over time, I think you'll see, oh my gosh, that's a bike helmet. And those are those Frappuccino lids?
Why, yes. So in terms of both of these projects, which are, again, happening basically cheek by jowl, mm-hmm. I mean, you're really not giving yourself a lot of breathing space for this. But in terms of sort of the trajectory of what Milwaukee Opera Theater has been doing, I mean, this just seems like it seems so natural. Like this is absolutely what you would be doing at this point.
It does feel like a really elegant evolution from, in terms of trying to help improve the environment for performing artists in Milwaukee and create opportunities for growth for them artistically. So we're kind of growing pretty hugely. Yeah, to commission a new opera from Joel to when I first spoke with Edward at a children's dance class at Danceworks, actually, and kind of tossed out the fact that we might be doing this piece at UWM, and I think you said people have been telling me I should do that piece for years. And so as soon as someone says something like that back to me, you go, oh, okay, well, I guess we'll be working on this then.
I guess,
you know,
this,
I
is
guess
a partnership.
This is the yeah. way, yeah, you yeah. know, it's meant to be, I think, so we ought to do this. And so, yeah, we're very busy trying to develop opportunities for a lot of people to practice their craft.
I want to thank all three of you for coming in. And I know we didn't have enough time to go into any real detail, but thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jill Anaponicek is the artistic director of the Milwaukee Opera Theater. Joel Boyd is a Milwaukee-based composer. And Edward Winslow is a choreographer and puppet maker who teaches at UWM's Peck School of the Arts. There's information about this weekend's Eurydice Festival at Carroll University and about the L'Enfant et le Sortilège performances in mid-February from links at wuwm.com/lake effect. That's also where you can find a picture of Anton, the frog puppet, taken in the Lake Effect studio. That's Lake Effect for a Thursday. Tomorrow on the show, the continuing presence of a major department store in the Grand Avenue Mall, plus how problems with your dental health might signal something larger. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for being with us today, and I sure hope you'll be able to tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.